like taser wires. Leo's friends both crumpled to the floor. Leo lunged to help them, but the two armored mannequins that couldn't possibly move did move. They drew their swords and stepped toward Leo. The one on the left turned its crooked helmet, which was shaped like a wolf's head. Despite the fact that it had no face or mouth, a familiar hollow voice spoke from behind its visor.
"You cannot escape us, Leo Valdez," it said. "We do not like possessing machines, but they are better than tourists. You will not leave here alive."
Chapter 39. Leo. Leo agreed with Nemesis about one thing. Good luck was a sham. At least when it came to Leo's luck. Last winter, he had watched in horror while a family of Cyclopes prepared to roast Jason and Piper with hot sauce. He'd schemed his way out of that one and saved his friends all by himself, but at least he'd had time to think. Now, not so much. Hazel and Frank had been knocked out by the tendrils of a possessed steampunk bowling ball. Two suits of armor with bad attitudes were about to kill him. Leo couldn't blast them with fire. Suits of armor wouldn't be hurt by that. Besides, Hazel and Frank were too close. He didn't want to burn them, or accidentally hit the piece of firewood that controlled Frank's life. On Leo's right, the suit of armor with a lion's head helmet creaked its wiry neck and regarded Hazel and Frank, who were still lying unconscious.
"A male and female demigod," said Lionhead. "These will do, if the others die."
Its hollow face mask turned back to Leo.
"We do not need you, Leo Valdez."
"Oh, hey," Leo tried for a winning smile. "You always need Leo Valdez."
He spread his hands and hoped he looked confident and useful, not desperate and terrified. He wondered if it was too late to write Team Leo on his shirt. Sadly, the suits of armor were not as easily swayed as the Narcissus fan club had been. The one with the wolf head helmet snarled,
"I have been in your mind, Leo. I helped you start the war."
Leo's smile crumbled. He took a step back.
"That was you?"
Now he understood why those tourists had bothered him right away, and why this thing's voice sounded so familiar. He'd heard it in his mind.
"You made me fire the ballista?" Leo demanded. "You call that helping?"
"I know how you think," said Wolfhead. "I know your limits. You are small and alone. You need friends to protect you. Without them, you are unable to withstand me. I vowed not to possess you again, but I can still kill you."
The armored dudes stepped forward. The points of their swords hovered a few inches from Leo's face. Leo's fear suddenly made way for a whole lot of anger. This Eidolon in the wolf helmet had shamed him, controlled him, and made him attack New Rome. It had endangered his friends and botched their quest. Leo glanced at the dormant spheres on the work tables. He considered his tool belt. He thought about the loft behind him, the area that looked like a sound booth. Presto. Operation Junk Pile was born.
"First, you don't know me," he told Wolfhead. "And second, bye."
He lunged for the stairs and bounded to the top. The suits of armor were scary, but they were not fast. As Leo suspected, the loft had doors on either side, folding metal gates. The operators would have wanted protection in case their creations went haywire. Like now. Leo slammed both gates shut and summoned fire to his hands, fusing the locks. The suits of armor closed in on either side. They rattled the gates, hacking at them with their swords.
"This is foolish," said Lionhead. "You only delay your death."
"Delaying death is one of my favorite hobbies," Leo scanned his new home.
Overlooking the workshop was a single table like a control board. It was crowded with junk, but most of it Leo dismissed immediately. A diagram for a human catapult that would never work, a strange black sword, Leo was no good with swords, a large bronze mirror. Leo's reflection looked terrible. And a set of tools that someone had broken, either in frustration or clumsiness. He focused on the main project. In the center of the table, someone had disassembled an Archimedes sphere. Gears, springs, levers, and rods were littered around it. All the bronze cables to the room below were connected to a metal plate under the sphere. Leo could sense the celestial bronze running through the workshop like arteries from a heart, ready to conduct magical energy from this spot.
"One basketball to rule them all," Leo muttered.
This sphere was a master regulator. He was standing at ancient Roman mission control.
"Leo, Valdez," the spirit howled, "open this gate or I will kill you."
"A fair and generous offer," Leo said, his eyes still on the sphere. "Just let me finish this. A last request, all right?"
That must have confused the spirits because they momentarily stopped hacking at the bars. Leo's hands flew over the sphere, reassembling its missing pieces. Why did the stupid Romans have to take apart such a beautiful machine? They had killed Archimedes, stolen his stuff, then messed with a piece of equipment they could never understand. On the other hand, at least they'd had the sense to lock it away for 2,000 years so that Leo could retrieve it. The Eidolons started pounding on the gates again.
"Who is it?" Leo called.
"Valdez,"
Wolfhead bellowed.
"Valdez who?"
Leo asked. Eventually the Eidolons would realize they couldn't get in. Then, if Wolfhead truly knew Leo's mind, he would decide there were other ways to force his cooperation. Leo had to work faster. He connected the gears, got one wrong, and had to start again.
Hephaestus's hand grenades, this was hard.
Finally, he got the last spring in place. The ham-fisted Romans had almost ruined the tension adjuster, but Leo pulled a set of watchmaker's tools from his belt and did some final calibrations. Archimedes was a genius, assuming this thing actually worked. He wound the starter coil. The gears began to turn. Leo closed the top of the sphere and studied its concentric circles, similar to the ones on the workshop door.
"Valdez," Wolfhead pounded on the gate. "Our third comrade will kill your friends."
Leo cursed under his breath. "Our third comrade." He glanced down at the spindly-legged taser ball that had knocked out Hazel and Frank. He had figured Eidolon number 3 was hiding inside that thing, but Leo still had to deduce the right sequence to activate this control sphere.
"Yeah, okay," he called. "You got me. Just a sec."
"No more seconds," Wolfhead shouted. "Open this gate now, or they die."
The possessed taser ball lashed out with its tendrils and sent another shock through Hazel and Frank. Their unconscious bodies flinched. That kind of electricity might have stopped their hearts. Leo held back tears. This was too hard. He couldn't do it. He stared at the face of the sphere. 7 rings, each one covered with tiny Greek letters, numbers, and zodiac signs. The answer wouldn't be pi. Archimedes would never do the same thing twice. Besides, just by putting his hand on the sphere, Leo could feel that the sequence had been generated randomly. It was something only Archimedes would know. Supposedly, Archimedes' last words had been, "Don't disturb my circles." No one knew what that meant, but Leo could apply it to this sphere. The lock was much too complicated. Maybe if Leo had a few years, he could decipher the markings and figure out the right combination. But he didn't even have a few seconds. He was out of time, out of luck, and his friends were going to die.
"A problem you cannot solve," said a voice in his mind.
Nemesis. She'd told him to expect this moment. Leo thrust his hand in his pocket and brought out the fortune cookie. The goddess had warned him of a great price for her help. As great as losing an eye. But if he didn't try, his friends would die.
I need the access code for this sphere, he said.
He broke open the cookie. Chapter 40. Leo. Leo unfurled the little strip of paper. It read, "That's your request? Seriously?" Over. On the back, the paper said, "Your lucky numbers are 12, Jupiter, Orion, Delta, 3, Theta, Omega. Wreak vengeance upon Gia, Leo Valdez." With trembling fingers, Leo turned the rings. Outside the gates, Wolfhead growled in frustration.
"If friends do not matter to you, perhaps you need more incentive. Perhaps I should destroy these scrolls instead. Priceless works by Archimedes."
The last ring clicked into place. The sphere hummed with power. Leo ran his hands along the surface, sensing tiny buttons and levers awaiting his commands. Magical and electrical pulses coursed via the celestial bronze cables and surged through the entire room. Leo had never played a musical instrument, but he imagined it must be like this, knowing each key or note so well that you didn't really think about what your hands were doing. You just concentrated on the kind of sound you wanted to create. He started small. He focused on one reasonably intact gold sphere down in the main room. The gold sphere shuddered. It grew a tripod of legs and clattered over to the taser ball. A tiny circular saw popped out of the gold sphere's head, and it began cutting into Taser Ball's brain. Leo tried to activate another orb. This one burst in a small mushroom cloud of bronze dust and smoke.
"Oops," he muttered. "Sorry, Archimedes."
"What are you doing?" Wolfhead demanded. "Stop your foolishness and surrender."
"Oh, yes. I surrender," Leo said. "I'm totally surrendering."
He tried to take control of a third orb. That one broke, too. Leo felt bad about ruining all these ancient inventions, but this was life or death. Frank had accused him of caring more for machines than people, but if it came down to saving old spheres or his friends, there was no choice. The fourth try went better. A ruby-encrusted orb popped its top and helicopter blades unfolded. Leo was glad Buford the Table wasn't here. He would have fallen in love. The ruby orb spun into the air and sailed straight for the cubbyholes. Thin golden arms extended from its middle and snapped up the precious scroll cases.
"Enough," Wolfhead yelled. "I will destroy the..."
He turned in time to see the ruby sphere take off with the scrolls. It zipped across the room and hovered in the far corner.
"What?"
Wolfhead cried.
"Kill the prisoners!"
He must have been talking to the taser ball. Unfortunately, taser ball was in no shape to comply. Leo's gold sphere was sitting on top of its sawed-open head, picking through its gears and wires like it was scooping out a pumpkin. Thank the gods. Hazel and Frank began to stir.
"Bah!"
Wolfhead gestured to Lionhead at the opposite gate.
"Come! We will destroy the demigods ourselves."
"I don't think so, guys."
Leo turned toward Lionhead. His hands worked the control sphere, and he felt a shock travel through the floor. Lionhead shuddered and lowered his sword. Leo grinned.
"You're in Leo world now."
Lionhead turned and stormed down the stairs. Instead of advancing on Hazel and Leo, he marched up the opposite stairs and faced his comrade.
"What are you doing?" Wolfhead demanded. "We have to..."
Blong. Lionhead slammed his shield into Wolfhead's chest. He smashed the pommel of his sword into his comrade's helmet, so Wolfhead became flat, deformed, not very happy Wolfhead.
"Stop that,"
Wolfhead demanded.
"I cannot,"
Lionhead wailed. Leo was getting the hang of it now. He commanded both suits of armor to drop their swords and shields and slap each other repeatedly.
"Valdez,"
called Wolfhead in a warbling voice.
"You will die for this."
"Yeah," Leo called out. "Who's possessing who now, Casper?"
The machine men tumbled down the stairs, and Leo forced them to jitterbug like 1920s flappers. Their joints began smoking. The other spheres around the room began to pop. Too much energy was surging through the ancient system. The control sphere in Leo's hand grew uncomfortably warm.
Frank! Hazel! Leo shouted. Take cover!
His friends were still dazed, staring in amazement at the jitterbugging metal guys, but they got his warning. Frank pulled Hazel under the nearest table and shielded her with his body. One last twist of the sphere, and Leo sent a massive jolt through the system. The armored warriors blew apart. Rods, pistons, and bronze shards flew everywhere. On all the tables, spheres popped like hot soda cans. Leo's gold sphere froze. His flying ruby orb dropped to the floor with the scroll cases. The room was suddenly quiet except for a few random sparks and sizzles. The air smelled like burning car engines. Leo raced down the stairs and found Frank and Hazel safe under their table. He had never been so happy to see those two hugging.
"You're alive," he said.
Hazel's left eye twitched, maybe from the taser shock. Otherwise, she looked okay.
What exactly happened?
Archimedes came through, Leo said. Just enough power left in those old machines for one final show. Once I had the access code, it was easy.
He patted the control sphere, which was steaming in a bad way. Leo didn't know if it could be fixed, but at the moment, he was too relieved to care.
The Eidolons? Frank said. Are they gone?
Leo grinned.
My last command overloaded their kill switches. Basically locked down all their circuits and melted their cores.
In English? Frank asked.
I trapped the Eidolons inside the wiring, Leo said. Then I melted them. They won't be bothering anyone again.
Leo helped his friends to their feet.
You saved us, Frank said.
Don't sound so surprised.
Leo glanced around the destroyed workshop.
Too bad all this stuff got wrecked. But at least I salvaged the scrolls. If I can get them back to Camp Half-Blood, maybe I can learn how to recreate Archimedes' inventions.
Hazel rubbed the side of her head.
But I don't understand. Where is Nico? That tunnel was supposed to lead us to Nico.
Leo had almost forgotten why they'd come down here in the first place. Nico obviously wasn't here. The place was a dead end. So why?
Oh.
He felt like there was a buzzsaw sphere on his own head, pulling out his wires and gears.
Hazel, how exactly were you tracking Nico? I mean, could you just sense him nearby because he was your brother?
She frowned, still looking a bit wobbly from her electric shock treatment.
Not totally. Sometimes I can tell when he's close, but, like I said, Rome is so confusing, so much interference because of all the tunnels and caves.
You tracked him with your metal-finding senses, Leo guessed. His sword?
She blinked.
How did you know?
You'd better come here.
He led Hazel and Frank up to the control room and pointed to the black sword.
Oh no.
Hazel would have collapsed if Frank hadn't caught her.
But that's impossible. Nico's sword was with him in the bronze jar. Percy saw it in his dream.
Either the dream was wrong, Leo said, or the giants moved the sword here as a decoy.
So this was a trap, Frank said. We were lured here.
But why? Hazel cried. Where's my brother?
A hissing sound filled the control booth. At first, Leo thought the Eidolons were back. Then he realized the bronze mirror on the table was steaming.
Ah, my poor demigods.
The sleeping face of Gia appeared in the mirror. As usual, she spoke without moving her mouth, which could only have been creepier if she'd had a ventriloquism puppet. Leo hated those things.
You had your choice, Gia said.
Her voice echoed through the room. It seemed to be coming not just from the mirror, but from the stone walls as well. Leo realized she was all around them. Of course, they were in the earth. They'd gone to all the trouble of building the Argo II so they could travel by sea and air, and they'd ended up in the earth anyway.
I offered salvation to all of you, Gia said. you could have turned back. Now it is too late. You've come to the ancient lands where I am strongest, where I will wake.
Leo pulled a hammer from his tool belt. He whacked the mirror. Being metal, it just quivered like a tea tray. But it felt good to smash Gia in the nose.
In case you haven't noticed, Dirtface, he said, your little ambush failed. Your three Eidolons got melted in bronze, and we're fine.
Gia laughed softly.
Oh, my sweet Leo. You three have been separated from your friends. That was the whole point.
The workshop door slammed shut.
You are trapped in my embrace, Gia said. Meanwhile, Annabeth Chase faces her death alone, terrified and crippled, at the hands of her mother's greatest enemy.
The image in the mirror changed. Leo saw Annabeth sprawled on the floor of a dark cavern, holding up her bronze knife as if warding off a monster. Her face was gaunt. Her leg was wrapped up in some sort of splint. Leo couldn't see what she was looking at, but it was obviously something horrible. He wanted to believe the image was a lie, but he had a bad feeling it was real, and it was happening right now.
The others, Gia said. Jason Grace, Piper McLean, and my dear friend Percy Jackson. They will perish within minutes.
The scene changed again. Percy was holding Riptide, leading Jason and Piper down a spiral staircase into the darkness.
Their powers will betray them, Gia said. They will die in their own elements. I almost hoped they would survive. They would have made a better sacrifice. But alas, Hazel and Frank, you will have to do. My minions will collect you shortly and bring you to the ancient place. Your blood will awaken me at last. Until then, I will allow you to watch your friends perish. Please, enjoy this last glimpse of your failed quest.
Leo couldn't stand it. His hand glowed white hot. Hazel and Frank scrambled back as he pressed his palm against the mirror and melted it into a puddle of bronze goo. The voice of Gia went silent. Leo could only hear the roar of blood in his ears. He took a shaky breath.
Sorry, he told his friends. She was getting annoying.
What do we do? Frank asked. We have to get out and help the others.
Leo scanned the workshop, now littered with smoking pieces of broken spheres. His friends still needed him. This was still his show. As long as he had his tool belt, Leo Valdez wasn't going to sit around helplessly watching the demigod Death Channel.
I've got an idea, he said, but it's going to take all three of us.
He started telling them the plan. Chapter 41. Piper. Piper tried to make the best of the situation. Once she and Jason had gotten tired of pacing the deck, listening to Coach Hedge sing Old MacDonald, with weapons instead of animals, they decided to have a picnic in the park. Hedge grudgingly agreed.
Stay where I can see you.
What are we, kids? Jason asked. Hedge snorted.
Kids are baby goats. They're cute, and they have redeeming social value. You are definitely not kids.
They spread their blanket under a willow tree next to a pond. Piper turned over her cornucopia and spilled out an entire meal. Neatly wrapped sandwiches, canned drinks, fresh fruit, and for some reason, a birthday cake with purple icing and candles already lit. She frowned. Is it someone's birthday? Jason winced.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Jason!
There's too much going on, he said. And honestly, Before last month, I didn't even know when my birthday was. Thalia told me the last time she was at camp.
Piper wondered what that would be like, not even knowing the day you were born. Jason had been given to Lupa, the wolf, when he was only 2 years old. He'd never really known his mortal mom. He'd only been reunited with his sister last winter.
July 1st, Piper said. The calends of July.
Yeah, Jason smirked. The Romans would find that auspicious. The first day of the month named for Julius Caesar. Juno's sacred day. Yippee!
Piper didn't want to push it, or make a celebration if he didn't feel like celebrating.
16? She asked. He nodded. Oh boy, I can get my driver's license.
Piper laughed.
Jason had killed so many monsters and saved the world so many times that the idea of him sweating a driving test seemed ridiculous. She pictured him behind the wheel of some old Lincoln with a student driver sign on top and a grumpy teacher in the passenger seat with an emergency brake pedal.
Well, she urged, blow out the candles.
Jason did. Piper wondered if he'd made a wish, hopefully that he and Piper would survive this quest and stay together forever. She decided not to ask him. She didn't want to jinx that wish, and she definitely didn't want to find out that he'd wished for something different. Since they'd left the Pillars of Hercules yesterday evening, Jason had seemed distracted. Piper couldn't blame him. Hercules had been a pretty huge disappointment as a big brother, and the old river god Achelous had said some unflattering things about the sons of Jupiter. Piper stared at the cornucopia. She wondered if Achelous was getting used to having no horns at all. She hoped so. Sure, he had tried to kill them, but Piper still felt bad for the old god. She didn't understand how such a lonely, depressed spirit could produce a horn of plenty that shot out pineapples and birthday cakes. Could it be that the cornucopia had drained all the goodness out of him? Maybe now that the horn was gone, Achelous would be able to fill up with some happiness and keep it for himself. She also kept thinking about Achelous's advice.
If you had made it to Rome, the story of the flood would have served you better.
She knew the story he was talking about. She just didn't understand how it would help. Jason plucked an extinguished candle from his cake. I've been thinking. That snapped Piper back to the present. Coming from your boyfriend, I've been thinking was kind of a scary line.
About? She asked.
Camp Jupiter, he said. All the years I trained there. We were always pushing teamwork, working as a unit. I thought I understood what that meant. But honestly, I was always the leader, even when I was younger.
The son of Jupiter, Piper said. Most powerful kid in the Legion. You were the star.
Jason looked uncomfortable, but he didn't deny it. Being in this crew of seven, I'm not sure what to do. I'm not used to being one of so many, well, equals. I feel like I'm failing.
Piper took his hand. You're not failing.
It sure felt that way when Chrysaor attacked, Jason said. I've spent most of this trip knocked out and helpless.
Come on, she chided. Being a hero doesn't mean you're invincible. It just means that you're brave enough to stand up and do what's needed.
And if I don't know what's needed?
That's what your friends are for. We've all got different strengths. Together, we'll figure it out.
Jason studied her. Piper wasn't sure that he bought what she was saying, but she was glad he could confide in her. She liked that he had a little self-doubt. He didn't succeed all the time. He didn't think the universe owed him an apology whenever something went wrong, unlike another son of the sky god she'd recently met. Hercules was a jerk, he said, as if reading her thoughts. I never want to be like that. But I wouldn't have had the courage to stand up to him without your taking the lead. You were the hero that time.
We can take turns, she suggested.
I don't deserve you.
You're not allowed to say that.
Why not?
It's a breakup line.
Unless you're breaking up. Jason leaned over and kissed her. The colors of the Roman afternoon suddenly seemed sharper, as if the world had switched to high definition. No breakups, he promised. I may have busted my head a few times, but I'm not that stupid.
Good, she said. Now, about that cake, her voice faltered. Percy Jackson was running toward them, and Piper could tell from his expression that he brought bad news. They gathered on deck so that Coach Hedge could hear the story. When Percy was done, Piper still couldn't believe it. "So Annabeth was kidnapped on a motor scooter," she summed up, "by Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn."
"Not kidnapped, exactly," Percy said, "but I've got this bad feeling."
He took a deep breath, like he was trying hard not to freak out.
"Anyway, she's gone. Maybe I shouldn't have let her, but..."
"You had to," Piper said. "You knew she had to go alone. Besides, Annabeth is tough and smart. She'll be fine." Piper put some charm speak in her voice, which maybe wasn't cool, but Percy needed to be able to focus. If they went into battle, Annabeth wouldn't want him getting hurt because he was too distracted about her. His shoulders relaxed a little.
"Maybe you're right. Anyway, Gregory, I mean Tiberinus, said we had less time to rescue Nico than we thought. Hazel and the guys aren't back yet?"
Piper checked the time on the helm control. She hadn't realized how late it was getting.
"It's 2 p.m. We said 3 o'clock for a rendezvous."
"At the latest," Jason said. Percy pointed at Piper's dagger.
"Tiberinus said you could find Nico's location. You know, with that."
Piper bit her lip. The last thing she wanted to do was check Catoptris for more terrifying images.
"I've tried," she said. "The dagger doesn't always show what I want to see. In fact, it hardly ever does."
"Please," Percy said. "Try again."
He pleaded with those sea-green eyes, like a cute baby seal that needed help. Piper wondered how Annabeth ever won an argument with this guy.
"Fine," she sighed and drew her dagger.
"While you're at it," said Coach Hedge, "see if you can get the latest baseball scores. Italians don't cover baseball worth beans."
"Shh."
Piper studied the bronze blade. The light shimmered. She saw a loft apartment filled with Roman demigods. A dozen of them stood around a dining table as Octavian talked and pointed to a big map. Reyna paced next to the windows, gazing down at Central Park.
"That's not good," Jason muttered. "They've already set up a forward base in Manhattan." "And that map shows Long Island," Percy said.
"They're scouting the territory," Jason guessed, "discussing invasion routes." Piper did not want to see that. She concentrated harder. Light rippled across the blade. She saw ruins, a few crumbling walls, a single column, a stone floor covered with moss and dead vines, all clustered on a grassy hillside dotted with pine trees.
"I was just there," Percy said. "That's in the old forum."
The view zoomed in. On one side of the stone floor, a set of stairs had been excavated, leading down to a modern iron gate with a padlock. The blade's image zoomed straight through the doorway, down a spiral stairwell, and into a dark cylindrical chamber like the inside of a grain silo. Piper dropped the blade.
"What's wrong?" Jason asked. "It was showing us something."
Piper felt like the boat was back on the ocean, rocking under her feet.
"We can't go there."
Percy frowned.
"Piper, Nico is dying. We've got to find him. Not to mention, Rome is about to get destroyed."
Her voice wouldn't work. She'd kept that vision of the circular room to herself for so long. Now she found it impossible to talk about. She had a horrible feeling that explaining it to Percy and Jason wouldn't change anything. She couldn't stop what was about to happen. She picked up the knife again. Its hilt seemed colder than usual. She forced herself to look at the blade. She saw two giants in gladiator armor sitting on oversized praetor's chairs. The giants toasted each other with golden goblets as if they'd just won an important fight. Between them stood a large bronze jar. The vision zoomed in again. Inside the jar, Nico D'Angelo was curled in a ball, no longer moving. All the pomegranate seeds eaten.
"We're too late," Jason said.
"No," Percy said. "No, I can't believe that. Maybe he's gone into a deeper trance to buy time. We have to hurry."
The blade's surface went dark. Piper slipped it back into its sheath,
trying to keep her hands from shaking. She hoped that Percy was right and Nico was still alive. On the other hand, she didn't see how that image connected with the vision of the drowning room. Maybe the giants were toasting each other because she and Percy and Jason were dead.
"We should wait for the others," she said. "Hazel, Frank, and Leo should be back soon."
"We can't wait," Percy insisted.
Coach Hedge grunted.
"It's just two giants. If you guys want, I can take them."
Coach," Jason said, "that's a great offer, but we need you to man the ship. Or go the ship. Whatever." Hedge scowled.
"And let you three have all the fun?"
Percy gripped the satyr's arm.
"Hazel and the others need you here. When they get back, they'll need your leadership. You're their rock."
"Yeah," Jason managed to keep a straight face. "Leo always says you're his rock. You can tell them where we've gone and bring the ship around to meet us at the forum."
"And here."
Piper unstrapped Catoptris and put it in Coach Hedge's hands. The satyr's eyes widened. A demigod was never supposed to leave her weapon behind, but Piper was fed up with evil visions. She'd rather face her death without any more previews.
"Keep an eye on us with the blade," she suggested, "and you can check the baseball scores."
That sealed the deal. Hedge nodded grimly, prepared to do his part for the quest.
"All right," he said, "but if any giants come this way..."
"Feel free to blast them," Jason said.
"What about annoying tourists?"
"No," they all said in unison.
"Ah, fine. Just don't take too long or I'm coming after you with ballistae blazing."
Chapter 42. Piper. Finding the place was easy. Percy led them right to it, on an abandoned stretch of hillside overlooking the ruined forum. Getting in was easy, too. Jason's gold sword cut through the padlock and the metal gate creaked open. No mortal saw them. No alarms went off. Stone steps spiraled down into the gloom.
"I'll go first," Jason said.
"No,"
Piper yelped. Both boys turned toward her.
"Pipes, what is it?" Jason asked.
"That image in the blade. You've seen it before, haven't you?" She nodded, her eyes stinging.
"I didn't know how to tell you. I saw the room down there filling with water. I saw the three of us drowning."
Jason and Percy both frowned.
"I can't drown," Percy said, though he sounded like he was asking a question.
"Maybe the future has changed," Jason speculated. "In the image you showed us just now, there wasn't any water." Piper wished he was right, but she suspected they wouldn't be so lucky.
"Look," Percy said. "I'll check it out first."
"It's fine. Be right back." Before Piper could object, he disappeared down the stairwell. She counted silently as they waited for him to come back. Somewhere around 35, she heard his footsteps, and he appeared at the top, looking more baffled than relieved.
"Good news, no water," he said. "Bad news, I don't see any exits down there. And, weird news. Well, you should see this."
They descended cautiously. Percy took the lead, with Riptide drawn. Piper followed, and Jason walked behind her, guarding their backs. The stairwell was a cramped corkscrew of masonry, no more than 6 feet in diameter. Even though Percy had given the all clear, Piper kept her eyes open for traps. With every turn of the stairs, she anticipated an ambush. She had no weapon, just the cornucopia on a leather cord over her shoulder. If worse came to worst, the boy's swords wouldn't do much good in such close quarters. Maybe Piper could shoot their enemies with high-velocity smoked hams. As they wound their way underground, Piper saw old graffiti gouged into the stones. Roman numerals, names and phrases in Italian. That meant other people had been down here more recently than the Roman Empire, but Piper wasn't reassured. If monsters were below, they'd ignore mortals, waiting for some nice juicy demigods to come along. Finally, they reached the bottom. Percy turned.
"Watch this last step."
He jumped to the floor of the cylindrical room, which was 5 feet lower than the stairwell. Why would someone design a set of stairs like that? Piper had no idea.
Maybe the room and the stairwell had been built during different time periods. She wanted to turn and exit, but she couldn't do that with Jason behind her, and she couldn't just leave Percy down there. She clambered down, and Jason followed. The room was just like she'd seen it in Catoptris's Blade, except there was no water. The curved walls had once been painted with frescoes, which were now faded to eggshell white with only flecks of color. The domed ceiling was about 50 feet above. Around the back side of the room, opposite the stairwell, 9 alcoves were carved into the wall. Each niche was about 5 feet off the floor and big enough for a human-sized statue, but each was empty. The air felt cold and dry. As Percy had said, there were no other exits.
All right, Percy raised his eyebrows. Here's the weird part. Watch.
He stepped to the middle of the room. Instantly, green and blue light rippled across the walls. Piper heard the sound of a fountain, but there was no water. There didn't seem to be any source of light except for Percy's and Jason's blades.
Do you smell the ocean? Percy asked.
Piper hadn't noticed at first. She was standing next to Percy, and he always smelled like the sea. But he was right. The scent of salt water and storm was getting stronger, like a summer hurricane approaching. An illusion? She asked. All of a sudden, she felt strangely thirsty.
I don't know, Percy said. I feel like there should be water here. Lots of water. But there isn't any. I've never been in a place like this.
Jason moved to the row of niches. He touched the bottom shelf of the nearest one, which was just at his eye level. This stone. It's embedded with seashells. This is a nymphium. Piper's mouth was definitely getting drier.
A what?
We have one at Camp Jupiter, Jason said. On Temple Hill. It's a shrine to the nymphs. Piper ran her hand along the bottom of another niche. Jason was right. The alcove was studded with cowries, conches, and scallops. The seashells seemed to dance in the watery light. They were ice cold to the touch. Piper had always thought of nymphs as friendly spirits, silly and flirtatious, generally harmless. They got along well with the children of Aphrodite. They loved to share gossip and beauty tips. This place, though, didn't feel like the canoe lake back at Camp Half-Blood, or the streams in the woods where Piper normally met nymphs. This place felt unnatural, hostile, and very dry. Jason stepped back and examined the row of alcoves. Shrines like this were all over the place in ancient Rome. Rich people had them outside their villas to honor nymphs, to make sure the local water was always fresh. Some shrines were built around natural springs, but most were man-made.
So, no actual nymphs lived here?
Piper asked hopefully. Not sure, Jason said. This place, where we're standing, would have been a pool with a fountain. A lot of times, if the nymphium belonged to a demigod, he or she would invite nymphs to live there. If the spirits took up residence, that was considered good luck.
For the owner, Percy guessed. But it would also bind the nymphs to the new water source, which would be great if the fountain was in a nice sunny park with fresh water pumped in through the aqueducts.
But this place has been underground for centuries, Piper guessed. Dry and buried. What would happen to the nymphs?
The sound of water changed to a chorus of hissing, like ghostly snakes. The rippling light shifted from sea blue and green to purple and sickly lime. Above them, the 9 niches glowed. They were no longer empty. Standing in each was a withered old woman, so dried up and brittle they reminded Piper of mummies. Except mummies didn't normally move. Their eyes were dark purple, as if the clear blue water of their life source had condensed and thickened inside them. Their fine silk dresses were now tattered and faded. Their hair had once been piled in curls, arranged with jewels in the style of Roman noblewomen. But now their locks were disheveled and dry as straw. If water cannibals actually existed, Piper thought, this is what they looked like.
What would happen to the nymphs?
Said the creature in the center niche. She was in even worse shape than the others. Her back was hunched like the handle of a pitcher. Her skeletal hands had only the thinnest papery layer of skin. On her head, a battered wreath of golden laurels glinted in her roadkill hair. She fixed her purple eyes on Piper.
What an interesting question, my dear. Perhaps the nymphs would still be here, suffering, waiting for revenge.
The next time that she got a chance, Piper swore she would melt down Catoptris and sell it for scrap metal. The stupid knife never showed her the whole story. Sure, she'd seen herself drowning, but if she'd realized that 9 desiccated zombie nymphs would be waiting for her, she never would have come down here. She considered bolting for the stairs, but when she turned, the doorway had disappeared. Naturally. Nothing was there now but a blank wall. Piper suspected it wasn't just an illusion. Besides, she would never make it to the opposite side of the room before the zombie nymphs could jump on them. Jason and Percy stood to either side of her, their swords ready. Piper was glad to have them close, but she suspected their weapons wouldn't do any good. She'd seen what would happen in this room. Somehow, these things were going to defeat them.
"Who are you?" Percy demanded.
The central nymph turned her head.
"Ah, names. We once had names. I was Hagnall, the first of the 9.
Piper thought it was a cruel joke that a hag like her would be named Hagno, but she decided not to say that. "The 9?" Jason repeated. "The nymphs of this shrine. There were always 9 niches."
"Of course."
Hagno bared her teeth in a vicious smile.
"But we are the original 9, Jason Grace. The ones who attended the birth of your father."
Jason's sword dipped. "You mean Jupiter? You were there when he was born?"
"Zeus, we called him then,"
Hagno said.
"Such a squealing whelp. We attended Rhea in her labor. When the baby arrived, we hid him so that his father, Kronos, would not eat him. Ah, he had lungs, that baby. It was all we could do to drown out the noise so Kronos could not find him. When Zeus grew up, we were promised eternal honors, but that was in the old country, in Greece."
The other nymphs wailed and clawed at their niches. They seemed to be trapped in them, Piper realized, as if their feet were glued to the stone along with the decorative seashells.
"When Rome rose to power, we were invited here," Hagno said. "A son of Jupiter tempted us with favors. A new home, he promised. Bigger and better. No down payment. An excellent neighborhood. Rome will last forever." "Forever,"
the others hissed.
"We gave in to temptation,"
Agno said.
"We left our simple wells and springs on Mount Lycaeus and moved here. For centuries our lives were wonderful. Parties, sacrifices in our honor, new dresses and jewelry every week. All the demigods of Rome flirted with us and honored us."
The nymphs wailed and sighed.
"But Rome did not last,"
Agno snarled.
"The aqueducts were diverted. Our master's villa was abandoned and torn down. We were forgotten, buried under the earth, but we could not leave. Our life sources were bound to this place. Our old master never saw fit to release us. For centuries we have withered here in the darkness. Thirsty, so thirsty."
The others clawed at their mouths. Piper felt her own throat closing up.
"I'm sorry for you," she said, trying to use charm speak. "That must have been terrible, but we are not your enemies. If we can help you..."
"Oh, such a sweet voice,"
Hagno cried.
"Such beautiful features. I was once young like you. My voice was as soothing as a mountain stream. But do you know what happens to a nymph's mind when she is trapped in the dark, with nothing to feed on but hatred? Nothing to drink but thoughts of violence? Yes, my dear, you can help us."
Percy raised his hand.
I'm the son of Poseidon. Maybe I can summon a new water source."
"Ha!"
Hagno cried, and the other eight echoed.
Ha ha! Indeed, son of Poseidon, Agno said. I know your father well. Ephialtes and Otis promised you would come.
Piper put her hand on Jason's arm for balance.
The giants, she said. You're working for them?
They are our neighbors, Agno smiled. Their chambers lie beyond this place where the aqueduct's water was diverted for the games. Once we have dealt with you, once you have helped us, the twins have promised we will never suffer again.
Agno turned to Jason.
You, child of Jupiter, for the horrible betrayal of your predecessor who brought us here, you shall pay. I know the Sky God's powers. I raised him as a baby. Once, we nymphs controlled the rain above our wells and springs. When I am done with you, we will have that power again. And Percy Jackson, child of the Sea God, from you, we will take water. An endless supply of water.
Endless? Percy's eyes darted from one nymph to the other. Look, I don't know about endless, but maybe I could spare a few gallons.
And you, Piper McLean?
Agno's purple eyes glistened.
So young, so lovely, so gifted with your sweet voice. From you we will reclaim our beauty. We have saved our last life force for this day. We are very thirsty. From you three, we shall drink.
All nine niches glowed. The nymphs disappeared, and water poured from their alcoves. Sickly dark water. Like oil. Chapter 43. Piper. Piper needed a miracle. Not a bedtime story. But right then, standing in shock as black water poured in around her legs, she recalled the legend Achelous had mentioned, the story of the flood. Not the Noah's story, but the Cherokee version that her father used to tell her, with the dancing ghosts and the skeleton dog. When she was little, she would cuddle next to her dad in his big recliner. She'd gaze out the windows at the Malibu coastline, and her dad would tell her the story he'd heard from Grandpa Tom back on the res in Oklahoma.
This man had a dog, her father always began.
You can't start a story that way, Piper protested. You have to say, once upon a time.
Dad laughed. But this is a Cherokee story. They are pretty straightforward. So anyway, this man had a dog. Every day the man took his dog to the edge of the lake to get water. And the dog would bark furiously at the lake, like he was mad at it.
Was he?
Be patient, sweetheart. Finally, the man got very annoyed with his dog for barking so much, and he scolded it. Bad dog, stop barking at the water. It's only water. To his surprise, the dog looked right at him and began to talk.
Our dog can say thank you, Piper volunteered, and she can bark out.
Sort of. Her dad agreed. But this dog spoke entire sentences. The dog said, one day soon, the storms will come. The waters will rise, and everyone will drown. You can save yourself and your family by building a raft, but first you will need to sacrifice me. You must throw me into the water.
That's terrible, Piper said. I would never drown my dog.
The man probably said the same thing. He thought the dog was lying. I mean, once he got over the shock that his dog could talk. When he protested, the dog said, If you don't believe me, look at the scruff of my neck. I am already dead.
That's sad. Why are you telling me this?
Because you asked me to, her dad reminded her. And indeed, something about the story fascinated Piper. She had heard it dozens of times, but she kept thinking about it. Anyway, said her dad. The man grabbed the dog by the scruff of its neck and saw that its skin and fur were already coming apart. Underneath was nothing but bones. The dog was a skeleton dog.
Gross.
I agree.
So with tears in his eyes, the man said goodbye to his annoying skeleton dog and tossed it into the water, where it promptly sank. The man built a raft, and when the flood came, he and his family survived.
Without the dog?
Yes, without the dog. When the rains subsided and the raft landed, the man and his family were the only ones alive. The man heard sounds from the other side of a hill, like thousands of people laughing and dancing. But when he raced to the top, alas, down below he saw nothing except bones littering the ground. Thousands of skeletons of all the people who had died in the flood. He realized the ghosts of the dead had been dancing. That was the sound he heard.
Piper waited. And?
And nothing. The end.
You can't end it that way. Why were the ghosts dancing?
I don't know, Dad said. Your grandfather never felt the need to explain. Maybe the ghosts were happy that one family had survived. Maybe they were enjoying the afterlife. They're ghosts. Who can say? Piper was very unsatisfied with that. She had so many unanswered questions.
Did the family ever find another dog?
Obviously not all dogs drowned, because she herself had a dog. She couldn't shake the story. She never looked at dogs the same way, wondering if one of them might be a skeleton dog. And she didn't understand why the family had to sacrifice their dog to survive. Sacrificing yourself to save your family seemed like a noble thing, a very dog-like thing to do. Now, in the Nymphaeum in Rome, as the dark water rose to her waist, Piper wondered why the river god Achelous had mentioned that story. She wished she had a raft, but she feared she was more like the skeleton dog. She was already dead. Chapter 44 Piper. The basin filled with alarming speed. Piper, Jason, and Percy pounded on the walls looking for an exit, but they found nothing. They climbed into the alcoves to gain some height, but with water pouring out of each niche, it was like trying to balance at the edge of a waterfall. Even as Piper stood in a niche, the water was soon up to her knees. From the floor, it was probably 8 feet deep and rising fast.
"I could try lightning," Jason said. "Maybe blast a hole in the roof?" "That could bring down the whole room and crush us," Piper said.
"Or electrocute us," Percy added.
"Not many choices," Jason said.
"Let me search the bottom," Percy said. "If this place was built as a fountain, there has to be a way to drain the thing. You guys, check the niches for secret exits. Maybe the seashells or knobs or something."
It was a desperate idea, but Piper was glad for something to do. Percy jumped in the water. Jason and Piper climbed from niche to niche, kicking and pounding, wiggling seashells embedded in the stone, but they had no luck. Sooner than Piper expected, Percy broke the surface, gasping and flailing. She offered her hand, and he almost pulled her in before she could help him up.
"Couldn't breathe," he choked. "The water, not normal. Hardly made it back."
The life force of the nymphs, Piper thought. It was so poisoned and malicious, even a son of the sea god couldn't control it. As the water rose around her, Piper felt it affecting her, too. Her leg muscles trembled like she'd been running for miles. Her hands turned wrinkled and dry, despite being in the middle of a fountain. The boys moved sluggishly. Jason's face was pale. He seemed to be having trouble holding his sword. Percy was drenched and shivering. His hair didn't look quite so dark, as if the color was leaching out.
"They're taking our power," Piper said. "Draining us."
"Jason," Percy coughed, "do the lightning." Jason raised his sword. The room rumbled, but no lightning appeared. The roof didn't break. Instead, a miniature rainstorm formed at the top of the chamber. Rain poured down, filling the fountain even faster. But it wasn't normal rain. The stuff was just as dark as the water in the pool. Every drop stung Piper's skin.
"Not what I wanted," Jason said. The water was up to their necks now. Piper could feel her strength fading. Grandpa Tom's story about the water cannibals was true. Bad nymphs would steal her life.
"We'll survive," she murmured to herself.
But she couldn't charm speak her way out of this.
Soon the poisonous water would be over their heads. They'd have to swim, and this stuff was already paralyzing them. They would drown, just like in the visions she'd seen.